Okay, so now we're going to open up for questions, discussion. I think Margaret, are you right? Margaret's there with the microphone. People can come to her. She's not going to just run all over their hell's half acre. Well, but what we'll do, it's better if we have it, I think, from an audio standpoint in where you are up to here. I think it will capture it better according to what Matt said. So if anybody has a question, remarks, comments, feel free to proceed to where Margaret is.
Hello. Well, this question is it's either for Helga or Lynn or both. Let's see. So we organize for Glass-Steagall and a lot of these policies. We organize for HCR3, which, you know, puts a question of impeachment on the table. And then we discuss classical music. And the question I had was actually a little bit answered by Lynn because, I'm sorry, am I pronouncing your name right? I'm sorry, wherever she is. Okay, great. Okay. And because there's something about classical music and classical composition that you can't really legislate. I mean, we can legislate tuning. You can't legislate, you know, communicating profound ideas concerning the soul of man and beauty and truth. So, you know, the question is, how do you do it? You know, Lynn said a lot about it. I think this conference shows a lot about it, but I think there was more to discuss because it seems like what we're getting at is the question of love and the love of man, and that's definitely something you can't legislate. But I'd like to hear your comments on really how do we make sure we do this? Can you answer that?
Well, I think you all know, or most of you know, the Aesthetical Letters by Schiller. And, you know, he wrote this after the hope of the European Republicans had been disappointed, namely to take the American Revolution as a model to do the same thing in Europe. And at that point, the greatest hope to accomplish that was the French, because they had a constitutional movement, not a republic, but they wanted to have a constitutional monarchy. And as long as, you know, Condorcet was in charge, there was a good chance that this would have succeeded. And Friedrich Schiller and the Prussian reformers and all of these people were absolutely convinced that it would go on from there to Germany, to other European countries. And then naturally we know what happened. The Jacobine became terrorists. They got subverted. They chopped off the heads of people. They said, you know, they had not the right for life, liberty and pursuit of happiness, but, you know, equality comes from chopping off heads. You know, I mean, that's one way of getting equality. And so, you know, at that point, you know, Schiller, who had been given the honorary citizenship of France because they liked his early dramas very much, gave it back. He wanted to have nothing to do with the Jacobine terror. And then he wrote the Aesthetical Letters. And there were actually a comment on what do you do, and, you know, in I think in the second or third letter, he says, what do you do if you have a government which is corrupt and the masses are depraved? You know, and that, you know, in a certain sense, that the reason why I encourage people again and again to read that, because, you know, that is exactly the problem we have. All the governments are corrupt and evil or corrupt. And the masses, you know, I mean, I think we all know what the problem is with the masses. They have been, you know, subverted into liking depraved entertainment. They like things which are, you know, horrible. You know, Bruce Fine had his way of formulating it, and I have a little disagreement with him on the nature of man, but it is true. What are the video games other than enjoying killing? You know, and why is the borderline from massacres, you know, or watching videos to massacres such a thin line that it happens again and again? Because people have depraved emotions. So Schiller wrote this Aesthetical Letter, and he came to the very surprising answer to say that when you have this condition of bad government and rotten masses, there is only one way how you can redeem it, and that is through great classical art. Now, a lot of people, again, you know, give it a spin, and they say, ah, that means Schiller became unpolitical. You know, he didn't really take on these important questions. But in a certain sense, he said the reason why classical art is the only way is because his standard of classical art was the highest. And if you read, for example, the critique of Matthiessen and the critique of Bürger's poems, where he lays out his philosophy of what classical artists have to accomplish, it is absolutely applicable. Because he says an artist is only an artist when he is absolutely sure about the effect he has on the audience. An artist who goes up there and performs and does not know with scientific rigor what will be the impact in the minds and the hearts of the audience does not deserve the name artist. And how do you accomplish that? By only dealing with universal subjects and addressing that in the audience, which makes them receptive for these universal ideas. Now, that already eliminates almost every subject matter which you nowadays are presented with as art. Gossip, talk shows, little issues, so-called subjective crises, all the Scandinavian poets, Ibsen and many others, you know, all the people who deal with existential little problems are rejected. So it means you can only deal with those subjects which are universal to all mankind, which have a universal importance, and they have to be treated in a rigorous way. And Schiller says, before the artist dares to move the audience, he should become an ideal man himself, at least for the moment when he performs. Now, this is very important because, you know, you have frivolous artists, you know, who dare to use tricks and sensuous, like this higher tuning is a typical example, you know, that you go for effect. Naturally, it becomes more tense, as you could hear in this difference in the performance. You get a more tense effect, but the beauty was gone. I think you all could see that the lower tuning is much more, you know, the whole idea of this beautiful song comes across, while the other one is going for sensuous effects. So the artist has to become an ideal man in the moment he performs. Now, how do you do that? That's a good question. I mean, you have to, in a sense, and this is why, and I saw Jenny actually doing it, he said, this morning at the warm-ups, you know, she said, tune your mind. And that was exactly what you have to do. Or when Lynn says you have to lunge, you have to have the whole composition in your head before you start with the first note. And that kind of throwing out all the garbage. Orlin called it the other day, the reason why classical culture is so important, because when you do it a lot, you develop a well-organized mind. And that is what it is all about. You have to throw out the garbage, to throw out the nastiness, the competition feeling, the how do I look feeling, all of these totally superfluous things which prevent you from being a true, loving, creative human being. And then you are that. You are in tune with the composer. You try to do art justice by being totally honest, by stepping behind the art. You don't perform yourself. You don't want to look pretty, sound pretty. You try to be truthful to the piece of art. And when you do that, you have exactly that effect on the audience. And I keep telling people, you know, some people, you know, they are beautiful beings when they teach music, when they sing music, and then when they stop, there is room for improvement. So one would wish that they just would keep singing all the time and never stop. And I think it is that training yourself to become to become a truly humanist human being. And I think that Schiller has said many other things in these letters and other writings, for example, that the tyrant can prohibit art, but he cannot rule in it. He can destroy it, but then everybody recognizes it's not art any longer. So art is the most precious instrument we have to improve people. And I think I would add one thing, you know, that's Lessing, because Lessing, I mean, the whole idea of the aesthetical education of man, I mean, it went back all the way to Aristotle. Aristotle wrote the Poetics, and he is dead wrong on everything he said. He said, you know, the actor, when he gets on the stage, has to feel the rage of the person. And then you have these people shrying, ah! You know, and they were rageful. And Schiller makes a polemic against it in the critique of Bürger's poems, because Bürger writes these poems, I have to cry my pain out. I have to cry my pain out. Ah! And, you know, Schiller says, this is horrible. You know, you have to go, sure, you have to know what anger is. You have to know what sorrow is. You have to train all of these emotions when you call them up in your performance. But it has to be an intellectual working through, and then you call it up like, you know, like you call it up, but you are not dominated by it. And this aesthetical education, you know, came rejecting Aristotle and his Poetics, and then step by step coming to the idea that for the aesthetical education, you need also compassion. And Lessing, who in one sense was the predecessor of Schiller, said for a good reason that you can learn passion, compassion, Mitleid, by the great classical drama. In rehearsing, so to speak, in a playful way, the kinds of moments which you in real life encounter all the time, but since people are not so witty and not so sharp, you do the wrong thing. Because it surprises you, and then you have a freak out and an emotion, and you afterwards you regret it. So Lessing says you have to look at classical great theater and rehearse it so that you are equipped in real life, that you have your emotions developed. And I fundamentally believe that, you know, the training of the emotions is a conscious matter, because otherwise you are not, you never get rid of these nasty things which we all have inherited by the society, like machoism, stupid competitiveness, and all of these things. You have to, if you don't get rid of them and become self-conscious, how can you be creative? You know, that's why you have a situation where people have the best ideas. They go to a meeting with Lynn, and then they go out and get into a fist fight over some stupid thing, you know. And you ask yourself, how could that possibly happen? They just had the most elevated experience to meet the most beautiful, genius human being on this planet, and then they plunge into this pit. You know, and it has to do with the fact that the education of emotion is not progressed beyond a certain point. And Herr Lessing, for example, said that the person who is the most compassionate, der mitleidigste Mensch, the most compassionate human being, is the best human being. You know, and that is, again, look at it, what the oligarchy does. The oligarchy says, let's have people completely detached. I don't go there, is a common word. Bertrand Russell wrote a book, Why I'm Not a Christian, in which he says that compassion makes people weak, and therefore don't be compassionate. Only weaklings and Christians are compassionate. And, you know, obviously, how do you get people to accept genocide in Africa? I don't go there. What do I care if a million people are dying in Africa? What has this to do with me? You know, and the reality is that the human identity should become that you weep when you see this. I really mean it, that you have to be able to cry about what you see in the world, because if you don't really get upset about what is happening with the youth culture, then you have not the force, the strength to fight it. I mean, you have to love these poor little schmucks, you know, and try to get them out of it. That's the emotion every good teacher has, because, you know, they want to get their pupils in a better condition. So I think that the only way I can imagine it, you know, you have, in a certain sense, you had the civil rights movement for which the spirituals were like the emotional strengths. You all remember Amelia's play, which was just a series of different spirituals, but telling the story of a slave family where some of the family members got sold off the block, auctioned off, you know, which I thought was unbelievably powerful. You know, and the spirituals were what gave people strength for the struggle. And I'm absolutely convinced that if we want to liberate the present population from the terrible, you know, control of the oligarchy, then they have to start to love classical music and go and sing, you know, Verdi, German songs. I'm absolutely certain when we get enough young people in Germany to discover the beauty of Schubert, Schumann, Mozart songs, Beethoven songs, and that they understand what they are deprived of by listening to, you know, things which really not only destroy your ears, but especially your cognitive power. And then that becomes like a liberation movement. So I think that is somehow in the air, because you have the Venezuelan people. I think there are several hundred thousand young people who already study classical music. You have a concert in Congo who performs an opera. You have now in Ecuador, there was a video where people made violins out of garbage. And it sounded quite okay, you know, I mean, but maybe not perfect. But, you know, it shows that there is an understanding that classical music is the way to liberate the mind. And given the fact that the governments are the way they are, I think we should spread the word. And, you know, when Lynn, basically made this beautiful concert in New York, I wrote an appeal for the Schiller Institute to go out and replicate it, recruit artists everywhere, study it yourself, you know, try to, you know, discover the beauty of great poetry, of great classical music, and communicate it. And make it a movement of resistance for beauty, because I totally believe that Schiller was absolutely on the mark, that the way to freedom goes to beauty. I'm absolutely certain, because beauty is more powerful than the hardest chains of the tyrant.
Thank you, Helga. And I want to add something to that and to the beautiful presentation given by Lynn. Is she still here? Yeah. And I thank you for that very moving presentation. I want to just add that even though it's obviously clear that educating the youth in this way is what is most crucial, and we had that in our panels today by several people when asked what to do, is just get to the youth. But we don't need to limit it to the youth. I want to just say a few things about the impact of classical music on adults. First, many of you remember that Norbert Breinin, whom John mentioned, and the pianist, his associate from Germany, Gunter Ludwig, did several concerts here in the United States for the Schiller Institute and for LaRouche. Actually, they did a concert the night before we all went to prison in honor of Lynn and those of us who were on our way to prison at Georgetown, which was very moving. But after I was locked up, they did a concert in Boston, which I heard a great deal about, and which was a concert for people mostly from the black population, people who had certainly never been to a classical music concert in most cases. And from everything I heard about that concert, it was like Lynn was describing with the children at this concert. Absolute silence, stunned by the beauty of this music. And I want to tell the story, which I've told many, many times, of when we were in prison, and oh, I'm sorry, excuse me. When we were in prison, we formed... When we were in prison, we formed a chorus of John or Paul Gallagher and myself of about 18 or 19 various kinds of criminals, some of them very serious criminals, some of them perverted in many ways, guilty of many very, very serious crimes. And none of them, with one exception, had ever performed or even heard classical music. And when we did this chorus, and we taught them Va Pensiero, we taught them Ave Verum Corpus, and the highlight was when we taught them the Prisoner's Chorus from from Fidelio's opera. And we did a couple of performances that were very moving, and you can actually hear the Prisoner's Chorus on our website if you haven't before. I encourage you to. But I want to add, because I think one of the most moving things that ever happened to me was not the concert per se, but that afterwards, every one of these people, with no exception, 19 of them, came up to me individually to say that this was the most moving experience of their life, that it's changed their life, that they'll never be the same. And I mean, this is real emotion, you know. This is what literally the dregs of society are capable of being moved in this way. So we have to take that with a sense of no holds barred, you know, go out. This is something that can be done in this society, as degenerate as this society is, as we all know. It's there to be done. What Lynn has done is just phenomenal. What Helga and the Schiller Institute have always aimed to do has to be done with a sense that this can be accomplished. It can be accomplished now, because it certainly can.
Any other questions or comments? Sure.
In the first panel, Helga ended her presentation with Kraft Erika, and I was just thinking about that throughout the entirety of the proceedings, and I was thinking about Kraft Erika's laws and his first one, which is very profound, and it says, there's no one or nothing under the natural laws of the universe which may impose limitations on man, but man himself. And I think that this is what we have experienced in the understanding here today, that if we wish to actually have the cultural paradigm shift in which this panel, this proceeding for the entirety of today has brought about, then what we have to do is understand that the principle that Kraft Erika was speaking of was not just something that was embodied by him, but it was an idea that was actually understood throughout and has been understood throughout the succession and throughout all of mankind. And you start to think about, this is what Christopher Columbus understood when he sailed the oceans. This is what those who came over and settled the Massachusetts Bay colonies understood. This is what was understood when we founded the Declaration of Independence, that there's no one or nothing under the natural laws of the universe that can impose limitations on man but man himself. This is what was understood in the minds of those who went through the struggle during the civil rights movement, not that those limitations could not be imposed on man. This is what was understood when President Kennedy said, we go to the moon and we do these things not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And so that's a principle that Kraft Erica understood that was something that has been the embodiment of mankind for quite some time. This idea that our, that what we represent is that we can make breakthroughs and we can make discoveries and we can actually find new frontiers, as in what we've done with Curiosity, what we've done with our missions to Mars, what we've done in our ability to now expound the boundaries of space and go where no man has ever gone before. And so I think that the proceedings of this conference reminds us again, as Kraft Erica said, that no one and nothing under the natural laws of the universe may impose limitations on man except man himself.
This question is primarily for Helga, but I know there's a lot of other people who also might have some things to say about this. But I had a discussion with some people last night, and the topic came up in terms of intervening into D.C. It was just raised, you know, why couldn't there be a town hall process in D.C.? And I said, well, it's kind of a weird place. It's sort of the entire country represented in one city, so people may not necessarily come up and say, I'm here to defend my city, because they're thinking about being from Chicago or Seattle or wherever they're from and representing that. But there is a certain process culturally that does exist. I mean, you do have classical culture in D.C. in terms of, yeah, it was classically developed. You have classical concerts that still take place even at lunchtime. There's concerts that are free. We don't even have this in any other city, so it's interesting. And so in the course of the discussion, it started to, I was provoked in just thinking about the potential for us to bring in more of classical culture into D.C. in terms of our role being, in addition to bringing the truth into the political system and influencing a huge change right now in the direction we're headed in, that there could also be a cultural intervention. And I know we've historically have done things that maybe I've only heard about. I don't understand because I wasn't there. I didn't, you know, I wasn't organizing for it with the Schiller Institute, in particular into D.C. But it just occurred to me that there's also a lot of institutional layers we intersect, events that could also be uplifted through classical culture. I mean, I went to the Congressional Black Caucus Conference this year, and it was striking to me that they had gospel night, but they didn't sing any spirituals. They didn't have, why didn't they have quartets, you know, sharing this classical culture? If they wanted to end the cycle of violence, why weren't they talking about Mozart? Why weren't they talking about this presentation that we had earlier about the effect on the youth culture? And when you have this, you know, endless cycle of violence with youth completely flying off the handle, killing their own families, their mothers, this would seem natural. So, I mean, the thought occurred to me, is there a potential also for bringing classical culture also into some of these institutional events? Is it just something maybe we're not thinking of? Is it something there's a potential there that maybe we haven't developed? Or is there a history of this that I'm not quite aware of? So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
The persona of these institutional people is so thick that you probably need a symphony with the Paukenschlag, you know, the boing. I think we should probably try it, because, you know, I mean, We tried once, as you probably remember, the Tomana chorus in this largest cathedral in Washington. And that was, you know, in a certain sense, the right way. You know, if we had more means, then that, you know, this was beautiful because the Tomana chorus made a concert tour throughout the United States. And we took one concert that in Washington. And while all the other concerts were high priced, $200 for a ticket or something, you know, it was very, no, I mean, this is a principle of the oligarchy because, you know, the oligarchy, they permit classical culture. Like, for example, in Germany, you have Rheingau Festival, Schleswig-Holstein Festival, Ruhr Festival, Saxony Festival. You have, in the summer, you have tons of festivals which go for 6 weeks or 8 weeks, and you have every evening some beautiful or not so beautiful classical performance, but the prices are unbelievably high. So a family of four cannot afford to go there unless they are upper class. And that has a purpose, you know, because it's an oligarchical thing. So what we did with the Tomana Corps was to have free entrance. We advertised it in the ghettos. And, you know, in Washington, you go one block out of the capital area and you are in the worst kind of slums and ghettos, you know, where people live in one room with one piece of furniture, a TV, and that is their entire life. So we opened it to all of these people. So I think it was 7,000 people. 7,000 people attended this concert. And, you know, I think we had some counter-organizing afterwards. I don't or before. Oh. Well, but obviously, you know, to maintain that kind of a thrust, you need also a little bit liquidity, which is sometimes a problem. So I want to invite people who want to help us to, you know, give donations so that we can do that. I mean, if somebody has a big fortune and wants to sponsor that, you know, do it. But otherwise, I think we should probably try it. We could try it maybe with a smaller event, with maybe a small section of... As a matter of fact, you know, we had a period in which we had no political event in Germany where we did not also have some music with it. Election campaigns, for example. And it's just very good, you know. I mean, I actually would have liked to have some music in the morning also to set the tone. And we can make that a habit, you know, that you know, every meeting starts with some musical piece, and we train people, we get them used to it. You know, I think it's wonderful because it transforms people immediately and tunes them in the right way for profound ideas to be discussed in the realm of politics. So we should think about it a little bit. What is the right format? Should it be a town meeting, maybe a luncheon with some, you know, invitations or so? But we should just play around it and see, you know. We should go to these Congress staff people, nibble on them, see who is acceptable for beauty, you know, and those we should pick and draw into, and then let it spread, because you always have to start with the best people and then spread it from there. So I think it's not a bad idea, and I think we should test it, because, you know, beauty conquers a lot of hardened souls, you know, people you cannot reach in any other way. I mean, Schiller said you have to move your audience to tears, you know, and when people not only have goosebumps, but, you know, they should really pour tears out of their eyes like rivers, you know, then you have done the job.
This is a question for Helga. Recently, Mr. LaRouche has spoken about how, for example, this event today, about how such an event can resonate with the tiny minority today who are thinking. And so in the context of those remarks, I was hoping that you could speak on what the nature of leadership is in this crisis in particular, but in crisis generally. That's what I got.
Well, I'm quite sure that we are standing in front of unbelievable developments. I mean, just because the crisis since 5.5 years, since July 7, 2007, has been going up and down, and then you had the 2008 thing, then for a short period of time, people were quite freaked out. Everybody was talking about new Bretton Woods all of a sudden, you know, because they were really scared. And then the bailout machine started to go, and now you have this more or less getting used to the crisis. But this is not going to be, because, I mean, the situation is so tense that either you have an uncontrolled explosion, and we are talking to bankers, you know. I mean, I like to tell this story because it is really, it gives you a sense. We have a very good contact who's an economic professor, who's a very, very distinguished elderly gentleman, has no, you would never think that he has any radical thoughts whatsoever. But he happens to really know this economic system. And when the I met him actually the day when the ESM decision went through, the European Stability Mechanism. And this gentleman, you know, is about 75 or so, he had a freak out, a yelling attack, where he said, these people, they should be executed. They should stand in the line for 1 hour because they are shot. Huh? And I said, wow. No, but then he basically, you know, I mean, he's not, we are against the death penalty and, you know, all of this. But he had such a vivid imagination of what will be the consequence on the people if this thing comes down. So he had this extreme statement of standrechtliche Erschießung, but standing there for 1 hour to wait. And that is really what is coming, you know. So I think what we need to do with this 5% is to really very, very quickly, you know, reach out. And you may have wondered why I wanted so many outside speakers at this conference, which was a little bit unbalanced. You know, we should have had a little bit more our people speaking, but it doesn't matter, because I think what we need to do right now is to have an outreach like never before. You know, I mean, just forget it in terms of who you are talking to. I think we need to have much more deliberation on, you know, how we use this situation. For example, if you look at the Middle East, you know, the Middle East is such a powder keg, and you have so many people who are genuinely, you know, genuine people. Like in Europe, we have gotten a whole bunch of organizations around us who are from the Syrian opposition, who are anti-Assad, but are not for the terrorists. In the same way, you have so many groupings right now which are totally, you know, they have nobody to go. And I think that the one thought which should come out of this conference is to really upgrade our conscious outreach to talk to people, that they have to get into the fight. I think we should take the appeal by Walter Jones as a starting point, because this is a perfect thing. We had a Republican congressman asking, we had a conference of I don't know how many people unilaterally voting by acclamation for it. So let's take that as a message and go out everywhere. And then combine it with the message of this conference that, you know, the best political fight will not succeed if you don't combine it with beauty. And then let's take the Magnificat and the presentations this evening, you know, and say these things have to go together. Because, you know, if you have a democratic rearrangement of the same people, they will do the same bad things. You know, you have to uplift people, and you have to say you have to fight for Glass-Steagall, but you have to combine it with a cultural leap to some other more beautiful ideas. And this is possible. Look, for example, I don't know, some of you were not born yet, but when the wall came down in Germany, this was an unbelievable period. I mean, you had over Christmas, you had two times the Ninth Symphony performed in the TV. And normally when you have a repetition. People freak out. They don't want to see the same movie two times in a row. But nobody, one was from Mansour, the conductor from Leipzig and Dresden, and the other one was from even Bernstein, but it you know, I mean, so what? And this was a period, you know, where people were feeling so elevated. You know, they wanted, it's what Lynn always quotes Shelley, that is the period when people are open for profound ideas because they realize that the foundations on which they have been standing are shaking, that nothing is functioning anymore. And then people are open for these ideas. And, you know, if, that's my biggest criticism to Helmut Kohl, if he would have had an inkling what was going on, that the population in all of Europe was absolutely ready, you know, they could have been elevated from a peaceful revolution into a renaissance. I mean, if Kohl at that point would have gone into TV and said, look, I talk to you, the peoples of Europe, I talk to the Ukrainians, to the Lithuanians, and please revive your most beautiful tradition. You had a renaissance exactly on the same level like the Italians. Make that alive. Let's have a diadem of nations where each nation is like a pearl in a beautiful arrangement. People would have responded, you know, because when such things happen, people want to have beautiful ideas and they want to be elevated. And I'm saying to you that, you know, we are going very shortly into a period where people will ask for fundamental conceptions. In 1945 in Germany, it was exactly like that. You know, the war had ended. I mean, it was a complete, you know, Germany was defeated. People were starving. The men were in prisoners, as prisoners of war. The women were rebuilding Germany from a rubble field with their hands. You know, this was an unbelievable moment, you know. And Furtwängler played concerts. Schlussnuss went into bombed out barns, you know. And people wanted to have, they wanted to have this music. There was a revival of natural law because people said we have to have laws to make sure that something so horrible never ever happens again. The famous word "never again," well, "never again war," was in everybody's mind because it was such a horrible experience. So, you know, unfortunately, this was then totally ruined because of Truman and the occupying powers then immediately wiped out this debate of natural law and imposed Dewey and, you know, all kinds of other positivist law instead of natural law. They rehabilitated all kinds of Nazis like Sartre and Heidegger and whatnot. It was a real conscious effort to stamp out this elevated mood in the population. You know, but I think that, you know, in the United States right now, you have a situation where all these movements have failed. The Tea Party has failed. The Occupy movement has failed. And why? Because they had no ideas. And I think we have to have a solemn commitment to go out of this conference and really get into a completely different mode on Glass-Steagall using the Walter Jones message to us and our acclamation, and, you know, get the whole country moving, state legislators, mayors, other elected officials, teachers, get everybody involved. Because I don't know if Dr. Shelley is still here, but, you know, the answer to his problems is Glass-Steagall and a functioning economy so that the medicine can be paid again, you know. So there is not one grouping which is not affected by this present thing. And I think we should, you know, eliminate all previous assumptions of who we should talk to and who not, you know, and really go out, make a complete revolution of beauty and, you know, add to the science and to the economy, add this classical culture, because that is the most powerful. I mean, it makes people happy. And when people are happy, they are healthy, you know. I mean, it's no miracle that, you have this study which we were discussing that there was a big fight if it was 55% or what. I don't care. But a very large percent of people are regarded to be psycho cases in the United States and who knows where else. But, you know, if, even if it's only 20%, you know, I mean, who cares? It's frightening, you know. And the reality is with classical music, people become mentally healthy. That's a fact. I mean, the Romantics, E.T.A. Hoffmann went into the insane asylums and studied cases and then wrote his novels. And the psychoanalysis goes back to the early Romantics, consciously. R.E. Lang and all of these people consciously quote the Romantics as their model. And what is psychology today? They say, you have to learn to live with your neurosis. And your neighbors have to accept that you are a neurotic person. And then the conflict goes away because everybody agrees it's okay. You know, and that is exactly the opposite of what Schiller said. Schiller said, you have to overcome your problem by reaching the level of the sublime. And that is, I think, extremely important. And, you know, in a certain sense, I think everything is open now. We should really explode in all directions.
Hi, I'm Jane Bloomer. I'm a social worker, and I have fought long and hard. I've had huge ambivalence about this LaRouche business. But I tell you, it has been an education. So for those of you, the young lady who spoke about Washington and finding people that really can connect with LaRouche, do not underestimate how your work gets to one, but it takes a while. These are complex issues. Understanding the economy and Glass-Steagall is complicated. I had a pretty good high school education, and good old Alexander Hamilton came up, and I did learn a number of these principles, and I studied some in college, but I didn't take it too much beyond that. But these are heavy-duty principles, but they are within the grasp of us all. So that's my point, speaking from a person who is growing within the LaRouche movement. Now, as far as the classical culture, I played the piano. I was raised in that kind of home, and I had that advantage, and school did, and I did have band, and I did have chorus. So I was not deprived of those things, and they added to my life enormously. Now, why did I say that? I said that for a reason. I said that because when I went on into adulthood and enjoyed sharing concerts and events, it was with a small coterie. It was always a small coterie. Here, I feel like I'm in a community of those that really appreciate a deeper culture. So, and I always missed that. I always knew something was missing in my life. So I know that there are other people out there that have had similar experiences and want to find somebody else that they can share the joy of music, reading, depth, and so on without having to look for a reading group, for goodness sake. I mean, fine, nothing wrong with the reading. Now, the third point, one of the things that I've wrestled with, and I am something of a political observer. I've always been interested in history and government. I would have been a diplomat if I'd been able to speak another language besides English. I couldn't. So I became a social worker. Not a bad profession. Not a bad compromise. But I have to say that I do wonder whether LaRouche is not reaching out to those who are available. What about Cornel West at Princeton, or Tavis Smiley? They have written an amazing book about the Poverty Manifesto. Who else? I was thinking of Eleanor Holmes Norton. She's in Washington, D.C. Huh? She did. But she might support the young lady who would like to start a musical event in Washington. It is not just the slums, and it is not just the congressmen that are in Washington, D.C., for goodness sake. There are souls like me there, I'm sure. So I guess my missionary spirit is to say, do not give up. I'm certainly going out again. I will continue to challenge Dennis and Suzanne and Diane, but I also feel like I have a deeper understanding, and I know who I'm going to approach about Glass-Steagall, music, culture. It just sort of came together today, and thank you so very much.
Okay, John, you'll be the final one. Go ahead. Fine.
Well, Diane Sayre is not here tonight because of a flu, but on the Washington, D.C. question, when she was based in Washington, I know that one thing she did was she formed children's choruses on the east side there in the ghettos. But when she was running for Congress, in one of the debates, they said, what would you do when you get down there if you were elected? And she said, well, I would start a Capitol Hill chorus in the Congress. So I wonder if maybe there might be one way to break down or get some of these people to communicate with each other or something. If that might be a... Yeah. If we might get some congressmen interested.
Okay, so we're going to now conclude today's events. I want to thank everybody for coming, and I just want to do one thing, which is to tell Mike about the concert that Norbert did. It was in Birmingham, Alabama. It was 20 years ago this March, and it was on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of what was called the Children's March. He did it at the 16th Street Baptist Church, and it was organized by Bill Ferguson and about five organizers who spent, I think, 10 days in Alabama. They had about 650 people, and they worked with a group called the Foot Soldiers. The Foot Soldiers still exist, only a few of them, but the Foot Soldiers was a group that had actually preceded King. It was a group called the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. I mention all this because when Norbert went down to do the concert, I was there the day before and the day of the concert. And he and Gunter Ludwig spent most of the morning and early afternoon before the concert just walking through the church. They looked through the various pictures that were on display. The reason this is particularly important to know is because what Norbert realized, that he knew this, which is one of the reasons that he had insisted on doing this concert, was that this is the church that was blown up right after the March on Washington of 1963. And four girls were killed at their Bible study class. This event traumatized two people who were also Birmingham students at the time. One of them was named Angela Davis, some of you remember her, and the other one was named Condoleezza Rice, whose parents promptly insisted she never get involved with anything involving the civil rights movement exactly because of those events. And Norbert was very aware of this. He talked a lot about these things, but he was very silent. Norbert really didn't talk very much, those you know. He would tell jokes, but he never used words except when he had something very specific to say. The night of the concert, 10 minutes before 8, there was nobody there. And over the course of 10 to 15 minutes, 600 people showed up because these foot soldier, this organization, had such a reputation. And they told us that these people were going to show. And they were all there. Amelia spoke there, James Bevel spoke there, but the thing I remember, Mike, is that he played the César Franck Sonata, and the second movement of this. And he, and I asked Norbert, I said, why are you playing this? I mean, I heard it. He said, because they're going to understand it. And so in the second movement, which is very slow, it's very quiet, and all of a sudden a kid, 2-year-old, starts singing in the, singing along with Norbert. Norbert's playing. You know, it's the second movement. It's a slow movement. And, you know, I'm getting nervous. And Norbert turns and looks at the kid. He doesn't stop playing. And this beaming smile came on his face. And I realized what Norbert would have realized, right, is that this is the church where these 4 little girls got blown up. And here's a little kid with whom he's connected in a way that goes beyond words. The idea of that, and that Norbert's dramatic, intense affiliation with Lynn, which to this day we hear about, even among musicians here in New York City, who tell us that Norbert used to pick fights with violists and violinists here in the city around Lynn's political writings, not around the music. And then they would have to agree they were only going to sit there and play string quartets. We just found this out. So for all of those who may have, you didn't know Norbert, or you came in the organization, don't know what this is, what Helga has done and what the meaning of this Schiller Institute is, you saw today. And I would just encourage everybody, since you already got the marching orders from her and you know what Lynn's been saying about motive in fact, motive in truth, let's take what we started today and make a beautiful world, one song, one mind at a time, where we become that change that people need from us. I think we can do it. I think Norbert and other people exemplified that. And I just want to thank everybody for coming, and we'll see you at the next event.